Hello again and welcome back. A few weeks ago on this program, we chatted with St. Louis Public Radio science reporter Veronique LaCapra about her then forthcoming trip to the Galapagos Islands. Well, she is back now and working on a special report on that trip. She joins me in studio to talk about the journey. Welcome home, Veronique.
Thanks, Don.
Why did you remind us of the purpose and who was behind and what was behind this whole journey?
Right. So back in April, I had applied. PRX, which is the Public Radio Exchange, had put out a call for people to submit proposals for science stories. They had gotten some funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to do this. And so I put in a proposal, and I was lucky enough to get accepted. And so I ended up going to the Galapagos with two young women researchers from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, who are there studying a kind of malaria that affects birds.
I suspect for someone in your position, a science reporter, if you will, you hold a PhD, by the way, in this environmental studies. Is that correct?
Yeah, in ecology and evolution, actually.
Well, sorry. Yeah. I didn't mean to sell you short on that. But this must be a dream trip for someone like yourself, and certainly the young ladies. We'll talk about them. But for you.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I'm sort of like them in that I had always wanted to go to the Galapagos Islands. You know, I do have this background in ecology, and I think every ecologist wants to go to the Galapagos Islands because it's such an important place in the history of science and evolution.
Why so important? And we know the Charles Darwin connection, but he was there for a reason.
Right. Well, he was there when he was very young. He was only 26 years old when he was there, and he was the naturalist on this voyage of the HMS Beagle that was taking a big tour of South America. And they went to the Galapagos Islands. And it was only much, much later that what he saw there, some of the species that he saw there, the differences in the species among the islands, that helped to inspire him to develop his theory of evolution.
Can you go beyond that and be a little more specific about what he saw that led to these conclusions?
Yeah. Well, one of the things he saw was that there are birds called finches, which are little kind of sparrow-like birds, that have evolved on the different islands and adapted to eat different kinds of food. So they have very different beaks, for example. One of them is called a small ground finch, and that eats, you know, as it sounds, things off the ground, little insects on the ground. Another one is a cactus finch, which actually nests in these tall cactus trees that are there, and it has a longer beak so that it can get nectar inside the flowers of the cactus.
But we have finches here, and I'm sure they do similar kinds of things.
Sure, but I think what was striking in the Galapagos is there are species there that are found only there and nowhere else in the world, and they do vary from island to island. Some of these species, or subspecies maybe, exist only on a particular island, and I think that was striking.
Can you give me kind of a verbal description of what the Galapagos are like?
Well, there might not be what people expect, actually. They weren't quite what I expected. They're volcanic islands. They're about 600 miles off the coast of Ecuador in the Pacific. So they're very rocky. There are a lot of, they call them lava rocks. They're literally solidified lava, and you see that all over the place. So it's a very sort of, it can range in color from black to red to sort of brownish, but it's definitely looks volcanic when you see it. And but the lowlands, the part by the ocean, is really very dry. It's almost like the Southwest or something. It, you know, there's these big cactus trees, very scrubby, dry vegetation. Not really what I pictured when I picture sort of a tropical island. Mm-hmm. As you go up in elevation, though, the vegetation really changes, and you do get that more tropical vegetation as you get higher up.
What is it about the islands and their location that makes them unique with regard to the animal life there, if you will?
Right. Well, I think because they're so far out in the ocean and so isolated, the animals that got there long ago, basically they either got there because they drifted there across the ocean. They were able to swim there, or they were on, you know, some sort of debris that drifted over, or they flew there in the case of the birds. And so because once they got there, they were so isolated from the mainland, I think that's what led to this real differentiation in species that we just don't see on mainland South America.
Well, the two young ladies that you traveled with, tell me a little bit about them. And you mentioned that they were checking for an avian malaria, I believe it was, doing some research on that. Tell us about them and about their research.
Right. So one is Maricruz Jaramillo. She's actually from Ecuador, from the capital, Quito, so a big city. But she's always loved being out in nature, and it was always her dream to go to the Galapagos. And she's actually been there as a volunteer in the past, went there for her master's research at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. She was studying Galapagos hawks then. And now she's back again and looking into this kind of malaria that's affecting birds. So she's actually catching birds in big nets and taking blood samples and studying that. Her friend and colleague is Samoa Asigao. She's from Papua New Guinea, also a PhD student at UMSL. And Samoa is looking at sort of another piece of that story, which is the mosquitoes who are transmitting the disease from bird to bird.
We have a couple of sound clips of Samoa. Mm-hmm. And one of those that I'd like to hear now, just to elaborate what you were talking on, was trapping mosquitoes, which I think would be a fairly difficult thing to do. But let's hear that.
Every time I pour this water, in my mind I'm like thinking like, mosquitoes, please come to it. So I can trap more mosquitoes in the morning. Seriously, that's what I do every time. Oh, it smells good, right?
It smells good, right? Apparently it didn't smell good.
No, it didn't smell good at all. It does not smell good at all. So what she's doing is she's pouring this disgusting, smelly water that she's made. It's sort of, you know, she's kind of brewed it up. And because mosquitoes, female mosquitoes, like to lay their eggs in stagnant water. And so she's created this smelly water to try to attract the mosquitoes into the trap. And they get sucked in. There's a little fan that kind of sucks them up into the trap from the water.
No small irony in all of this. Most of us try to avoid mosquitoes. Here she is out looking for them. And then what? When she finds them, what does she do with them?
Well, it's pretty amazing, actually. She's going to bring some of them back to UMSL to do DNA analysis, and she's kind of looking at the population genetics of this one species in particular. But she's also, while she's there, dissecting them, which is really amazing to watch. I mean, she's got them under the microscope. You know, it has to be pretty brightly lit so she can see what she's doing. And she's got these little tools, and she's basically taking them apart, pulling off the wings and the legs, and then she cuts off the head and looks at the salivary glands, because that's where the malaria parasite would be if it was present and had been, you know, was being transmitted actively by the mosquito.
How big of a problem is this avian malaria?
You know, they don't know. That's part of what they're trying to figure out, is the extent to which birds have been affected in the Galapagos. They first found it, not them personally, but their lab group found it in 2009 in Galapagos penguins. That was the first time it was found. And a lot of the penguins, it turns out, have been affected by it, but are surviving. So what they're trying to figure out is, you know, is it killing a lot of birds? Are birds adapted to it? How long has it been there? These are all questions they're trying to answer.
Now, is this something that could spread beyond the Galapagos?
Well, I mean, it has spread beyond the Galapagos. It's affected birds in Hawaii already.
Well, as far away as Hawaii.
Yes. So it does exist in other places. In fact, one of the reasons there's concern about it is that in Hawaii, this was, I think, around 100 years ago now already, but it had caused the extinction of quite a few bird species in Hawaii. Now, they haven't seen that in the Galapagos. So that's kind of what they're looking to prevent, if at all possible.
But it has not jumped from the birds themselves to humans.
No. And this is a kind of malaria that does not affect humans.
Okay, well, that is certainly good to hear.
Right.
One of the things I wanted to chat with you about, and I know it's an interest of yours, is the emerging number of women who are becoming involved in the world of science. Give me some sense of that. How is it growing?
Well, you know, it really depends on the subfield of science. There are still parts of science, physics, engineering, those kinds of fields, mathematics, I would say, where there are just not very many women, actually, still today. Fields like ecology that Mari and Samoa are working in are, I would say, ecology has many more women. So it really varies across science, I would say.
This is something that Samoa is certainly cognizant of, and we have another clip of her talking about just that. She's very much aware of the role of women in today's science world.
Yeah, well, and she's from Papua New Guinea, which, you know, I was talking about the situation in the United States. In Papua New Guinea, it's a very rural country. I think 80% of the people still live in rural areas and very much adhere to kind of traditional ideas about the role that women should play. And so
empower young girls, empower women, and tell them, you know, if I can come from a country like Papua New Guinea, come and do research in a place like Galapagos and study at an institution like my university, then you can do it too.
I certainly understand the connection with Papua and the society there, but it's relevant here too, because the more women who do become involved is also an inspiration to people in this country, women in this country.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, where do we go from here with regard to women in science? I mean, you talk about some areas where there's a weak representation. How does that change, do you think?
Well, I think a lot of it is about role models, like Samoa is talking about. You know, the more young women, girls in, you know, junior high, whatever it takes, can be made comfortable with these other topics and realize that those are options for them, that they can do them just as well as men can, you know, then I think that's part of the answer, is starting really young and getting people interested.
Why has it taken so long, do you think? I mean, why have women been kind of sidetracked in this area?
Boy, that's a tough question. I don't really know how to answer that.
Well, let me ask you then about your own involvement mm-hmm. in it and how you got involved. I mean, I'm assuming that as a youngster, you were probably pretty much involved, interested in things that you're interested in today. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I was actually a lot like Mari in that I was the little kid who was out there in the swamp, you know, picking up the tadpoles. And I was really, I mean, I think, you know, kind of an old school naturalist almost as a little kid.
And how did you proceed? Was it difficult for you because you were female, or was it the same as for your male counterparts?
Yeah, honestly, I didn't really think about the fact that I was female. It was just something I was interested in and pursued. And I didn't really think about that. Growing up, I went to an all-girls school when I was in high school. And, you know, so we were very much encouraged to pursue whatever field we were interested in. Actually, my best subject in high school was math. So I guess I was fortunate in that regard.
I was going to say, that sounds like it was probably an advantage to not perhaps be competing with young men.
Yeah, maybe so. And just to have teachers who took it for granted that, you know, we would do anything that we wanted to do. So.
And I suppose there are teachers along the way in other kinds of educational environments who kind of point more toward the young male rather than the female for whatever reason.
Yeah, that could be. I mean, you know, there's obviously something going on. There must be some sort of bias that is discouraging people from going into certain fields, whether it's the people who are in the classroom with them or whether it's the teachers not sending out the right vibe. I don't know.
Well, we're glad you're in it. And as for these young ladies and their research, what happens now?
Well, they're still there, actually.
They are.
They're still in the Galapagos. Oh. Yep. We were on an island called Santa Cruz, which is where the Charles Darwin Research Station is. But after I left, they were going on to at least two more islands, I think, including the latest one they were on. They were actually there's no people who live on that particular island. And so they were going to be camping the whole time they were there.
Any problems with the authorities in the Galapagos for doing this kind of research and bringing material back with them?
I'm not sure I would term it a problem, but certainly the Galapagos National Park, which is the Ecuadorian authority there, is very protective of the islands. And there's a lot of bureaucracy. I had to go through a lot of bureaucracy to get permission to do this story. And certainly that's true for researchers also.
What about this country bringing some of those materials back? If, in fact, we're talking about an infectious disease, I can't imagine folks here are too anxious to have it in this country.
Yeah, I assume there are challenges when it comes to the USDA or whoever it might be at customs regulating some of that as well.
In the time we have left, tell us about the PRX STEM Story Project. What is that all about?
Right. So it was a project, as I said, to encourage science stories, radio stories in particular. I think they chose 16 people to do different stories. And there is a real range of topics. Some of them are already out. Some of them came out last week. And there's a handful left that will be coming out a bit later on, including mine. But the topics are all over the place. From one was about whale communication. There's another one looking into some of the issues around the forensics of studying fires and arson. So it's just all over the map.
You know, has the whales story aired yet? It seems to me I heard something fairly recently about the communication amongst whales.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's aired yet, but it's definitely up and available on the PRX website.
And when can we expect to hear Ms. La Capra's story?
Hopefully pretty soon. I'm hoping for early August sometime.
All right. Well, Veronique, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on a job that is being well done. I know you're working on it now, but we'll be looking forward to listening to that. And welcome home.
All right.
I'm sure it was a fantastic journey for you.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. That is Veronique La Capra, St. Louis Public Radio science reporter, just back from a trip to the Galapagos Island, and ever since she's been working fast and furious on the report that we'll be hearing one of these days in the not-too-distant future. Great to have you back home, Veronique. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the importance of early childhood education as well as its financial impact. Hope you'll be with us then. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.